Welcome to SCOTUS Cast, Navigability and Riverbed Ownership Edition. Thank you for tuning in. On February 22, 2012, the Supreme Court announced its decision in PPL Montana LLC versus Montana. This case involved a dispute over title to portions of various riverbeds in the state of Montana, riverbeds now occupied by hydropower projects owned by a utility company. The dispute turns on the extent to which the rivers involved are deemed navigable, because states generally take title to lands beneath navigable waters. The question before the court was whether the test for navigability looks only to the navigability of a river at the time the state joined the Union, or also includes subsequent and present-day use. The Montana Supreme Court ruled that the state of Montana owns and may charge the hydropower project's rent for use of the riverbed. In an opinion delivered by Justice Kennedy, the court unanimously reversed the decision of the Montana Supreme Court, declaring it, quote, based on an infirm legal understanding of the court's rules of navigability for title under the equal footing doctrine, end quote. The proper test, the court concluded, is whether, at the time of statehood, the pertinent segments of the river in question allowed the passage of a commercial vessel or instead required a portage. To discuss the case, we have Thomas Merrill, who is the Charles Evans Hughes Professor of Law at Columbia Law School. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Professor Merrill.
PPL Montana versus Montana is a case decided by the Supreme Court on Wednesday, February 22nd. It's a unanimous opinion by Justice Kennedy, which might lead you to think that it's nothing particularly interesting. But in fact, if you're a fan of Western history, it's a very fun read. And if you are interested in property rights, it also has a lot of interesting aspects to it. I think the case was granted by the court perhaps because it has certain similarities with the judicial takings controversy that the court split 4-4 on and Stop the Beach Renourishment in 2010. As it turned out, the case was not argued as a judicial takings case. It was argued as a case under the so-called equal footing doctrine, which determines title to the land underneath navigable waters. But the factual background is somewhat similar to the types of controversies that have given rise to arguments that something like a judicial takings doctrine may be needed. The issue involved the ownership of portions of the submerged land under three rivers in Montana where hydroelectric plants and dams have been constructed. Everyone in the case ultimately agreed that the answer to who owned the bed of the rivers in these locations was to be determined by an historical test. The question was whether the rivers were navigable, in fact, when Montana gained statehood in 1889. So the case turned on a factual determination of a state of affairs that had disappeared well over 120 years ago. Under something called the equal footing doctrine, each state is deemed to have the same rights to land under navigable waters as the original 13 states had. The original 13 states inherited the rights of the British Crown, and those rights included ownership of beds underneath waters that were subject to the ebb and flow of the tides. So in the early 19th century, the understanding is reached that not only the original 13 states, but subsequently admitted states should also be deemed to own the land underneath tidal waters. This was later extended in the 19th century to include land under any water which is navigable in fact, as well as waters that are washed by the tides. Three rivers in Montana, the Missouri, the Madison, and the Clark's Fork, have hydro dams on them. Some of these dams are over 100 years old. Montana had made no attempt during the life of these dams until fairly recently to claim ownership of the land on which the dams were built, no claim that the utilities owed rent or other payments to the state for the privilege of using the land on which the dams were built. One presumes that everybody in the state of Montana was more or less thrilled to have dams built, providing cheap electricity for the residents of Montana. In 2003, however, a non-governmental organization filed a lawsuit claiming that the dams were built on public land that was owned by the state, that the state had a duty to collect rent for the use of these lands that would go to a public school fund, and that the state's failure to collect the rent was a breach of the state's obligations under the public trust doctrine. After a while, the state decided to join the suit, taking the same position. And so the state of Montana essentially made a claim for back rent to the company which now owned the dams on these three rivers. The Montana State Trial Court granted summary judgment for the state, holding that the state indeed owned the land on which the dams were built. The state trial court also held that there was no statute of limitations or no estoppel doctrine or no laches doctrine because the state is sovereign, was not subject to any of these restrictions, and therefore the state could collect back rent going back as much as 100 years. It turned out that the back rent and interest for just 7 years, which was all that the district court calculated, was nearly $50 million. So the potential liability of the power company, if you went back 100 years, would be potentially quite enormous. The Montana Supreme Court affirmed in a divided decision that as long as the rivers were navigable as a whole, as long as each of these rivers had commerce moving along them in some fashion at the time Montana became a state, then all stretches of the river were navigable, even if there were particular segments of the river that were obstructed by rapids and waterfalls. So, for example, even the 17 miles near Great Falls, Montana, which is interrupted by five different waterfalls and interspersed with rapids and had to be portaged by Lewis and Clark for over a month when they originally explored the Missouri River, was deemed to be navigable by the state Supreme Court and owned by the state of Montana. When the case got to the Supreme Court, parties did not raise takings issues. They instead argued the case under the equal footing doctrine. The state of Montana reiterated its river as a whole position. It also argued that there was a presumption in favor of navigability, which meant that any doubts had to be resolved in favor of the state. And it argued that post-statehood evidence could be utilized to prove navigability if there was no adequate evidence of navigability in the documentary records at the time of statehood. So, for example, the fact that fishermen use flatboats and that people use kayaks on these rivers today was admissible evidence to show that the rivers were navigable at the time Montana became a state. The power companies, which were joined by the United States as amicus curiae, argued that the proper approach was instead to look at each segment of the river and to ask whether that particular segment was navigable or was not navigable. And the test that the power company in the United States eventually came up with focused on portaging. If the river was so obstructed by waterfalls or rapids that you had to get out of the boat and portage around it, then that obstruction would make that segment of the river non-navigable, and title to that would remain in the United States to be dispersed along with the rest of the federal public domain. If you could stay in the boat and perhaps just lift the boat up a little bit and keep going, then perhaps that would be navigable and the state would own the bed under those circumstances. The case was extremely well argued and briefed. The power company was represented by Paul Clement, former Solicitor General in the Bush administration. The state was represented by Gregory Gare, another Solicitor General during the Bush administration. And so it was first-rate advocacy. Justice Kennedy's opinion, in addition to offering a kind of novelistic travelogue about the history of Montana and these rivers and Lewis and Clark's expeditions, also summarizes the rather convoluted legal doctrine that applies to under the equal footing doctrine and establishes title to the beds of navigable waterways. Justice Kennedy completely endorses the segment-by-segment approach that was argued for by the power company and the United States, and adopts the sort of portage test that was argued for in implementing the segment-by-segment approach. So if there's an obstruction that's sufficiently difficult that requires you to get out of the boat, then it's not navigable. Kennedy added a caveat, which was really from the United States brief, that if the portage is so short or the obstruction is so short that the segment in question would be really not economically valuable or would be difficult to administer, then there's a de minimis exception to the segment-by-segment approach. But as long as the segment is sufficiently long that the land in question could be commercially developed, then the title remains in the United States, subject to distribution under the Public Lands Act, as opposed to being title in the state. With respect to the question of whether or not post-statehood evidence could be used, Justice Kennedy said it was logically relevant evidence, and so there couldn't be a per se rule exclusion of that type of evidence, but he cautioned that the relevant question was really whether boats that existed in 1889 were capable of floating up and down the river, not whether or not kayaks or flat-bottom fishing boats or other modern inventions could navigate through the waters. And so any type of post-enactment evidence, post-statehood evidence, had to be used with a considerable caution. One of the more interesting aspects of the case, at least to my eye, is that this case arose on a petition for certiorari from a grant of summary judgment to the state. The court seemed to, in effect, direct summary judgment for the power company, at least with respect to the 17-mile segment of water at Great Falls, Montana. Justice Kennedy was quite emphatic after his review of the record of the case that there was no plausible basis for saying that this 17-mile stretch could be navigated in 1889, and therefore he concluded, contrary to the Montana Supreme Court's decision, that the 17-mile Great Falls reach, at least from the head of the first waterfall to the foot of the last, is not navigable for purposes of riverbed tidal under the equal footing doctrine. So the court seemed to go quite a ways toward directing the outcome with respect to a very significant portion of the case. The other issues were remanded to the Montana courts for further consideration under the standard that the court had outlined, which seems to strongly point toward the power company and the United States prevailing with respect to the other segments as well. I think that the court's action in essentially granting what amounts to summary judgment to the power companies is, in a way, sending a strong message to the Montana Supreme Court and potentially to other state Supreme Courts that they have to be careful in their interpretation of property rights and decisions that would, in effect, overturn 100 years of understanding about ownership of an important resource like the bed of a river, and that have the effect of creating massive retroactive liability, are not to be taken lightly, and that the Supreme Court will stand ready to look closely at decisions that have that kind of consequence for parties. So maybe this is an illustration of ways in which the court can perhaps monitor or discipline sort of outlier decisions by state courts that seem to be inconsistent with established understandings of property rights without having to get into the extremely complicated mare's nest of issues presented by the judicial takings doctrine.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUS Cast. For more episodes of SCOTUS Cast, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at www.federalistsociety.org/multimedia.